since Oliver Stone's movie has just swept across the country, we've had so many alternative requests for meetings. And of course, when Stone is traveling, that's where we go. So last night we were in Cambridge at the John F. Kennedy Center School of Government in Harvard, and we had a terrific crowd there. So the alternative is to try to do the best we can to send the program out there to our friends by means of film. And I'm delighted to have you here, who we're old friends. We understand the subject together, and we'll try to talk about these important things that the film is bringing to today. Over 10 million people have already seen JFK by Oliver Stone.
I know in the JFK film by Oliver Stone, there's a character portrayed by Donald Sutherland who has a meeting in Washington, D.C. with a Mr. X. And I wanted people who've seen the film to realize that Mr. X is based on large part, in large part on your career. And I thought I'd let them know then who Mr. X is and who Colonel Fletcher Prouty is and the work that you've done. And so I'd like to start by asking you about your background in the U.S. military. When did you enlist, and what was your training, and what duty did you do? Did you see combat? What were your jobs in the military?
When Oliver Stone came to me for stating he was going to do the film, he had seen some things I wrote about my career in the service, and it tied in rather tightly. But I started before Pearl Harbor in 1941 as an actual horse cavalryman, which not too many people today can look back to. And I served after that, when we got rid of the horses in 1941, in the tanks, and actually served under General Abrams, who later became our senior officer in Vietnam. He was a friend of mine all through my military service. I already had a flying license, so the Air Force sent me a letter one day and suggested that I transfer from the tank corps into flying, which I did very with pleasure, went to flying school, immediately sent to Africa, where I served in the Africa Middle East wing of the Air Transport Command. One of the jobs I had there started me in this work that begins to be interesting as far as clandestine operations are concerned. I was sent to the Cairo Conference, the conference between Churchill, Roosevelt, and Chiang Kai-shek from China. And from there went directly to the Tehran Conference, which was between Roosevelt, Churchill, and Stalin. This was the first time they had met together. And what most people don't know is that Chiang Kai-shek, the Chinese leader, was there also. Now, this was November, December of 1943. And historians have still not been told that Chiang Kai-shek was there. How do I know? I was the pilot of the plane that flew them from Cairo to Tehran. Furthermore, in the air at the same time was a plane flown by a friend of mine, flying Elliot Roosevelt to Tehran. After my assignment in the Middle East, I was transferred to the Pacific, and there I flew heavy transports in the Pacific area until the war ended, when I was on Okinawa, mostly flying patients from that horrible Okinawa campaign back to hospitals in Hawaii. And one day we heard that the war had ended. It hadn't surrendered, but the Japanese had quit not long after the atom bombs were dropped, in August of 1945. And the unit I was flying with was asked immediately to start flying into Japan, the only air base we had not bombed, anticipating that we might need one when we went in there, was at Atsugi. Atsugi, and you will recall, rings a bell with our good friend Lee Harvey Oswald, because he was based at Atsugi. Most people probably don't realize that that was a major Japanese headquarters, all underground. What was above ground were just the runways and a few little hangars that had been all shot up. But later it became a major headquarters for CIA in the Far East, and that's why Oswald was there as a Marine augmenting the CIA's capabilities. Well, you know, there was another one of these coincidences in my career that became useful later, because I knew the base pretty well. I never met Oswald there. I was finishing up some of that flying The surrender had taken place on board the Missouri. And I went back to Okinawa after one flight, and some of my men needed uniforms, so I went down the harbor. A very odd thing was happening. Okinawa was loaded with equipment, stacked up three or four pallets high, because we had intended to invade Japan with 500,000 men, and the invasion didn't come off. So I saw all this stuff being reloaded onto these American ships, and I asked the harbor master, I said, is that going back to the States? He said, hell no, they never want to see all these tanks and guns and ambulances, 105-millimeter howitzers and all the rest of the stuff. He said, we're shipping this to Hanoi. And at that time, Hanoi didn't ring too many bells with me. I knew where it was, but it was not part of the war as far as we were concerned. And he said, that's half of it. The other half is going to Korea. And believe it or not, back there, with the end of World War II, somebody had made plans to provide an enormous stockpile of modern arms and equipment to Syngman Rhee in Korea and actually to Ho Chi Minh in Hanoi. And Ho Chi Minh in those days was accompanied by an American Army general named Gallagher and an OSS man named Conine, who both became famous later in the Vietnam War. So you see, acting as no more than an ordinary pilot doing my job, but getting some rather unusual assignments, you begin to acquire a little information that doesn't show up in history books. Who was it that ever, looking ahead that far, ordered the movement of that enormous stockpile of equipment specifically to Seoul, Korea, and to Hanoi in Vietnam? While I was doing that flying between Okinawa and Japan, I received orders from the Army to report to Yale University. The Air Force had never had a ROTC program because always was part of the Army program, but the Air Force was being made independent. And we had to start the program in some 166 colleges around the country, and three of us were sent to Yale to open the program at Yale. I taught there for 3 years, incidentally, the same 3 years that George Bush was an undergraduate there, and Bill Buckley and others who have become rather well known. And because when you start, you don't have the equipment that ordinarily a program would have, we had to write textbooks, and I was selected to write textbooks, go to New York City and work in a studio there. And I wrote the Air Force's textbook on aeronautics that were distributed to all the ROTC colleges. And as soon as that was done, I was asked to write the textbook on missiles and rockets, because we were just getting into that business. And it's a pleasure to be asked to write a book for the military, because the orders say, go anywhere, visit anyone, any factory, any university, and write the best book you can. Well, magnificent orders. One of the people I went to see was Wernher von Braun, who built the Apollo ship that went to the moon and who had been with the Germans in Peenemünde, you know, building the V-2 weapon in Germany. A terrific man. And I remember well von Braun talking with me, and I said, how do you intend to move a rocket from the Earth to the moon? Do you just aim like somebody shooting a pigeon? And he laughed, no. We put it in orbit around the Earth. And then the orbit will spin it off, and it will go to the moon, where it will go in orbit there. And then we'll have a lander, and you know the story. But here he was talking to me in 1949, saying what he was going to do in, 1969? I've always thought that was one of the most important forecasts I ever heard, and I wrote it up in the book that we produced. After writing those books, I was ordered to Colorado Springs, because by that time, the threat of Soviet attack on the United States had increased so much that we had to modernize our radar system, and we set up the big NORAD Air Defense Command business, and I stayed there for a year when the Korean War broke out, and I was transferred then to Tokyo, went back there, and I became the manager of the Tokyo International Airport, because while we were as an occupation force in Japan, We ran the country, and the Japanese were trying to rebuild after the horrible war. I never saw anything worse than Tokyo at the end of the war. It was so bad you could walk on a street and look across blocks of Tokyo and see nothing that would interfere with the trolley cars driving down the street. Even the ruins of the buildings were flat on the ground. I saw cities in the Soviet Union when I was flying in the Soviet Union in 1944 for the U.S. Air Force that were destroyed, but nothing like Tokyo. On our first flight up there, we saw Hiroshima, and that too was pretty bad. In this Korean War period, when we turned the airport back to the Japanese, I was made commander of a heavy transport squadron, and our regular duties were to fly to Southeast Asia. And in the Philippines in 52 and 53, we were working to change the government there. And the man that was leading that as a covert activity was a man named Edward G. Lansdale, who became well known later on. And we were flying supplies to him while he was building up his covert Filipino army under the leadership of Ramon Magsaysay. He succeeded in changing that government. Quirino had been the leader of the government. And he moved his people over, the Saigon military mission created by CIA, into Vietnam. And my job for flying included Saigon and Bangkok, actually all the way to Saudi Arabia, across South Asia. So we were in and out of those cities all that time until 1955. I was given orders to go back to the United States. I went to the Armed Forces Staff College, which is run by the Joint Chiefs of Staff, and from there was brought into the Pentagon in 1955. Under Eisenhower, the National Security Council had published a very important directive that defined covert operations. And in the process, the decision had been made that whenever the CIA was going to perform a covert operation, rather than duplicate equipment and bases and ships and aircraft, they would turn to the Air Force, to the military, and get equipment and use military equipment to the extent possible for the covert operation. So this meant that the services had to create an organization, a global organization, to be ready at any moment to provide this, to do it in great secrecy, so that money would never be short. We always charge the money to a special fund and run it in such a way that the agency could deny or plausibly disclaim, as the words in the law say, that the United States had anything to do with it. Well, this was pretty new in 1955. In fact, I had to create the office, and I became the Chief of Special Operations for the Air Force, and I stayed in that business for 5 years. It could be quite a story, but we'll skip that. At the end of that, I was transferred to work with the Office of the Secretary of Defense in an office called Office of Special Operations. From that point, we had all the services under this one office. And again, I was back in an office with Ed Lansdale. By that time, Lansdale, an Air Force officer in uniform, but a career CIA man, was in the Pentagon directing what later became Special Forces and things like that as that developed through the military. With the election of Kennedy, McNamara chose to disband that office and at the same time replace part of it with the DIA, a new organization, Defense Intelligence Agency. So he created that and put it under General Carroll and called me in one day and he said, "You've been in this business now for 7 years. You know all the people involved. You already know the agency people. You don't have to open up any new contacts. You know the agency's global organization. You go down to the Joint Chiefs of Staff and set up an office there to handle all the military support for all the services around the world for the CIA." Well, this coincided with the Kennedy administration. And I was there until Kennedy died in 1964. I retired. Well, this background information I wrote in a book called The Secret Team, and I wrote many articles about it later, and Oliver Stone, when he was thinking about doing the Kennedy murder, began to realize that the question about Kennedy's murder is not limited to who shot him, but why was he shot? If there's a lone gunman, you don't have to ask that question, because a lone gunman could have been an oddball, as they say, a lone nut. But if it's a conspiracy, and most of the people in this country now believe firmly that there was a major conspiracy involved in that, then you can't help facing the issue, why was President Kennedy killed? And Stone thought that was important enough to build on the Garrison book, which is probably one of the best books written on a subject about his trial and all of the antecedents to that, but to include also the Man X role, and that's how I backed into his film. See, he needed somebody to build it on who knew the other side of what was going on in Washington at that time. I didn't know he had made Man X until I saw the script some months later. But it was one way to present, as he does, the drama of that event. And of course, John, you're very familiar with that.
When you were providing military personnel, material, and support for these covert operations around the world, what did you see as their purpose, or was that a question that you asked?
John, I know you read my book, and I think this was at the heart of it. Having worked with the agency for 9 years, actually longer because it went back into the 40s, I came to a personal conclusion, but I think I had the professional experience to come to this conclusion, that most of the covert operations run by this government, and at that point you have to enlarge CIA because, as I explained, the military's in there, and if we need other departments like Treasury or FAA because of airplanes or something, it's a government project, but it originates in the other country, like Indonesia or the Congo, wherever you're working. It originates there. And that the covert operation really is a reaction to something learned in the foreign country. It's very important philosophically because you can't say really that it was a United States government plan. Now, if the CIA puts on its intelligence hat and is studying intelligence in Africa or some other place in the Middle East, and they come up with a need for secret intelligence, they actually run that with a different network because it usually doesn't require guns or anything. It's just secret intelligence. The distinction is not realized by too many people. But when you talk about the covert operations, you are talking about something that, in my opinion, with that much experience, is a reaction to something that started outside this country. There aren't too many that were designated here. The orders to assassinate the leader of the Congo originated here, but that's pretty rare.
I know that in much of your writing, you make a distinction between the type of involvement that you had in World War II, for instance, and these later wars. And I'm wondering, especially in the post-war period after World War II, whether you see warfare now as a sort of different element. How are wars planned, or what are the purposes of wars in the modern world?
This is something that I'm really rather surprised at the Society of Historians. I'm a very active member in the Society of Historians for American Foreign Relations. Thousands and thousands of men, mostly college professors. Even military writers seem to overlook this. The impact of the hydrogen bomb, more than the atomic bomb, but the hydrogen bomb is so enormous. The new bomb, fission, fusion, fission, all happening in a split second, is so enormous you can't plan a war. It's ridiculous. Because, for one thing, wars, for the most part, are started by people who have an interest in the war and who presume they're going to outlive the war, as the leaders of Germany and France and England and Russia did during World War II and the United States. Now no place to hide. You know, no place to hide is pretty true in the hydrogen bomb era. So in war planning, we used to do very formal war planning. We'd cut the Soviet Union up into sections and say, if we have to go with the Soviet Union, as we did in World War II, we'd invade here, we would go in by Murmansk, we'd go in by the Caspian Sea, with the first exchange being these super nuclear weapons. It's a new kind of war, and this is why we couldn't solve the war situation in Korea, because if we turned the hydrogen bombs in Korea, what would be there? Well, what would be worth fighting? A bunch of holes in the ground. And then radioactive for how many years? 80 years? 100 years? And the same in Vietnam. When generals in charge of the military in Vietnam would want to attack, you know, thinking Hanoi is the objective, like General Patton attacking across France, across Germany, shaking hands with the Russians, he knew what he was doing. That's war. But in Vietnam, the generals were told, you hold that area and you don't attack. You don't use nuclear weapons. We're not going into that super war business. This is the problem today, and this is what puts the emphasis on the covert wars. They're trying to find a new kind of thing by the attack in Panama, Grenada, Iraq. But just look back. I mean, what did they accomplish? You know, you can destroy people and you can destroy cities. But now, what did it accomplish, really? So your question is very basic, and it shows why this government and other governments are emphasizing the requirement for covert activities.
I know you've worked more recently on a book specifically about the Vietnam War called The Saigon Solution. And I know that you knew many of the people through your work in these support capacities that were part of the carrying out that war. And I thought you might want to talk a little bit about why you felt Vietnam began and how Vietnam ended.
One of the most momentous decisions in the early part of the Vietnam War, and I hate to say war in the beginning because, see, it started in, the Vietnam War really started on September 2nd, 1945, when Ho Chi Minh got up on a platform in Hanoi and read the Declaration of the Independence of Vietnam, written almost the same as our own declaration. And on one side was a U.S. Army Major General named Gallagher, and on the other side, as I said earlier, an OSS man named Conin. And we're supplying his weapons. But the objective then was to round up the Japanese and get the Japanese residual, the remaining forces, out of Vietnam. And the plan was then that the British would move in and gradually bring order to Vietnam, hoping to keep the French out because the Tehran Conference, an earlier conference, had ruled against the continuation of colonialism. It didn't work. The French got back in. So we switched our support from Ho Chi Minh to the French, and we began to fight the man we supported. And when the French were defeated at Dien Bien Phu, they were defeated with American weapons, which a lot of people would know but haven't thought much about, see? So the decisions to do this were done covertly, and the CIA brought people in what was called the Saigon Military Mission. It was not very often in Saigon. It was not military. And it had more to do with the Vietnam War, probably, than anything else. And that mission was headed by Edward G. Lansdale as a colonel in those days, with many others whose names we've heard throughout the period of the Vietnam War without realizing the enormously important role that they played when that mission was established in 1954. Our troops didn't land in Vietnam until 65. So it was all a CIA operation from 54 to 65.
Who were some of these people?
Well, his closest man, of course, was Conin, and then Bohannon. Bohannon was an Army officer, I believe in those days, Lieutenant Colonel. And Arthur Arundel, but he was on what we would call the psychological warfare, the civil affairs psychological warfare side. Rufus Phillips, Michael Hand, and some of these names we've heard. Michael Hand, for instance, years later, kind of left the CIA and with an Australian named Frank Nugent, started the Nugent Hand Bank. So much money was being made illegally in Vietnam, it couldn't all be sent home, so they had to put it somewhere. They put it in this Australian bank. The bank had over $1 billion when the United States had only about $15 billion banks in the country. And here this bank just grew up out of Vietnam with $1 billion. Well, the man running it then, half of it anyway, was Michael Hand. So you see the roles that worked themselves through the structure of what we call the Vietnam War were, some of them, rather interesting.
You mentioned the role of General Edward Lansdale in the Philippines and in an operation there that had to do with overthrowing the government and involvement with the Hucks. These people, I assume, were also key characters in other similar operations like the Bay of Pigs.
Yes. When the Bay of Pigs was being planned, one of the biggest problems was to try to stay within the Cuban exile community, but there were no trained leaders within that community that we could trust the leadership work to. Manuel Artima was probably as close as we came to a real good military leader. So the agency, using Lansdale's contacts, brought people in from around the world, but a good number of them from Manila, like Valeriano was actually Magsaysay's deputy when he was president of the Philippines for special forces type work, or they call civil action work. He came over and helped work on the Bay of Pigs program along with others. The Bay of Pigs program was really a lot more involved than we ever got a chance to see because of the unfortunate failure to do it properly. It had been pretty well carried out, and the air support was a function, and I mean more or less just the air transport, air paradrop support, not military type, was a function of the CIA's big proprietary airline known as CAT, or Civil Air Transport, or the Pacific Corporation, things like that. Their forces were all brought in for this. We created a special modification of the B-26 bomber for the Bay of Pigs operation. And had we been able to use it there, it would have done a most effective job.
I know some of the people like Richard Bissell and Charles Cabell and Alan Dulles seemed to follow through that history as well as later into Vietnam. People like Lou Conin, who you've mentioned. Mm-hmm. These were all in a circle either above or below Lansdale's position. Who was calling the shots in this group?
This is interesting. In covert activities, you develop the skills of people by function, not by geography. In the intelligence business, you try to keep people on a certain section of the map so that they know the geography, so they know the political situation, the economic situation. But in covert activities, it's not unusual to be using a man in the Congo and his team, trained team, and even if it involves other nationals. We use, for instance, Polish exiles widely. And you work them into teams, and then when you have the Indonesian rebellion, you move some of the same people in. Frank Wisner, the old OSS hand who was in Bucharest in Romania during World War II, became the leader of the Indonesian program. So your observation is correct, and Lansdale, of course, being really the legendary prime man in this business, was involved in many of these things, especially in the Pacific area.
This work included, I assume, also assassinations of government leaders or particular individuals. When did you begin to think that the assassination of President Kennedy might have fit this same mold?
I had known through experience that assassinations were called for in certain activities, usually as a fallback. Not you know, if you can talk a guy into leaving, you do it. But if it doesn't work, or if the other people in the country can't work with the man, even in a compromised situation, the decision is made that there must be an assassination. And during the 1976 hearings under the Church Committee in the Senate, this was finally revealed, even though the agency tried to overlook the situation. It never hit me more strongly than early in Kennedy's administration when a major general that I knew very well, Air Force officer, came back from a meeting in the White House. And as he went by the door of my office, which was just across the hall from his, he said, "Prouty, go down to personnel and get me retirement papers right now." So I went down to personnel, got him retirement papers. Here was a man that might have been chief of staff of the Air Force, a very well-known general. So as I brought the papers in, I, "What's the matter, General?" He said, "I can't agree with it." He said, "We're sitting in a White House. We're talking about a certain program." He said, "The man that they're talking about is as anti-communist as anyone in the world, although they have certain arguments against this man, and they're going to remove him. And they can't remove him peacefully. He won't go. They're going to kill him." He said, I'm quitting. I won't go through this. And he walked out of the Air Force that afternoon. Well, obviously, that was a lesson to me because I had not been personally in that kind of situation. Although I had provided aircraft for teams that were going for these jobs, I didn't ever see it that close as when that man told me what they had decided. Next morning, I read in the paper that the man was dead, the man, the head of the country. Put it together, you know, all you need to know about assassinations.
Did you have a sense at the time that you resigned in 1964 that that the murder of Kennedy was suspicious in some way?
By that time, in fact, within days, I was positive of it. There were so many things not done. The secret of an assassination plan is to remove the protection. If you've been living in a neighborhood where you think having a big German shepherd dog is necessary for your safety, and if that dog is gone, somebody come in the house because the dog's gone. They won't come when the dog's there. See, if you remove the protection, you're going to have somebody assassinated. And it was evident in the area of Dallas that the Secret Service coverage either didn't exist, was at a minimum, and that the normal military augmentation of Secret Service coverage had not even taken place. And although I happened to be in New Zealand on the day President Kennedy was killed, and I was having breakfast with a congressman from the United States, we heard on the radio that the president was shot dead. And as soon as we could, we went out on the street and bought a newspaper from a man selling extras. And I saw a picture on the front page of the paper of that Texas school book building, which I'm sure had to have been taken, you know, right away and photocopied and sent around the world. And windows were open. And I turned to the congressman, I said, you know, something is seriously wrong. The Secret Service closes windows. The military, you got plenty of people, close the windows and put stickers on them. Don't open a window till a president goes by. And then you put a man outside with a radio, and he looks at the building, just a glance at the building. He knows the windows are closed, so everything's all right. But if a window opens, he gets on the radio. There's a man up on a roof with a sniper gun watching, and other men come through the hall, go and see why the window was open and shut it. I mean, that's protection. You want to keep the president alive. You're not going to take the bubble top off his car. You're not going to put him in a car that isn't armored. The Secret Service didn't use an armored car. If the bubble had been on it anyway, it was nothing. It wouldn't have stopped the bullet. J. Edgar Hoover made a report to Johnson on that. He said that bubble top, whether it was on or not, didn't make any difference. It was worthless. He said, I wouldn't ride in that car across the street. So we noticed immediately, just being off in New Zealand in this paper, things that when I got back to Washington, I found out there's no way in the world that the president had been protected properly. Well, that can't happen. You train thousands of military men to do the job. They're going to do the job. That's their business. You train Secret Service men year in and year out to do the job. They're going to do it. But I called one of the military units to talk to a friend of mine because I had worked on that kind of business. And he said, you know, somebody called my colonel and said, we don't need your unit in Dallas. Well, he wasn't too shocked, although he was only in San Antonio and could have come up easily, because he figured they were going to put another unit in Dallas, and you know, it wasn't his job, he'd stay there. He found out afterwards that they didn't. Well, then who called? Who knew ahead of time, for reasons of the assassin's point of view, not to have that military unit there? You know, he would have to know code words, he would have to know all the secrets of how this thing is done. And I've done that. I've gone to Mexico City when Eisenhower went down there, preparing the road for our military units to augment Secret Service in Mexico City. We use extreme caution. It took weeks. And then Eisenhower just casually walked down the Avenida, the main street in the middle of town, and he's safe. At least he's as safe as you can make it. Well, that didn't happen. And you could see that right away in that first newspaper. And then when I got back to my office with the JCS and I had other resources to check other things, by the time I retired, and it wasn't just because of that, I had already arranged a job, but it was pretty much my whole idea of what I was doing came to an end right there. 9 years was enough. And I had no doubts that the murder was a carefully planned job and that Oswald was a patsy, no question about it. And that the murderers were professionals that I knew existed, because Lyndon Johnson himself, before he died, said, "We operate a murder incorporated," meaning we operate people who can murder, but incorporated. That means in perpetuity. A business that is incorporated means perpetual. He further said, "I believe there was a conspiracy," and he said, "I believe that Oswald did not do it himself." Those are printed words that are available. Anybody wants to go to the library. So, you know, there were no doubts in my mind, and I think thousands of other people could see that also.
I know in my own research, I noticed similar things. For instance, the decision to take the double turn from Main Street to Houston and Elm that slowed the car down considerably, and the completely wrong reaction of the Secret Service driver on hearing the first of the gunfire to hit the brake instead of the gas, making it possible for an assassin to take a closer aim rather than both those things slowed the car down and made the assassination an easier hit or more possible. And there were other indications in that direction. But beyond that, many unusual things happened that day, November 22nd, at levels even above the planning in Dealey Plaza that led me to think that this had to have been orchestrated in a military fashion as a coup d'etat on the highest level. You know the story well about my mother and the Pentagon, knowing that the plans about Vietnam were reversed immediately. I also, in my work with enlisted people during the Vietnam War, talked to Strategic Air Command bomber pilots at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base who were in the air that hour and told me that when they heard the news that Kennedy had been shot, they raced for their code books, the books in special lockers that link them to the cryptic codes from the White House, command rooms, or the different command and control centers, or the president himself, that would have allowed them to participate in a nuclear or national emergency response. In each of the planes in the air that hour, they told me no code books were to be had. The lockers were empty. That's reported also for Air Force One by Pierre Salinger. We have reports that the entire communication grid in the federal offices went down for a period of an hour and a half to 2 hours at the time Kennedy was shot. And I wondered if your work, and looking at it from your angle, you saw things that made you feel that this had to have been more than just the security being withdrawn, but an operation planned at the top.
Well, you know, I think I've told you, John, I was aware of your mother's role, that the work she did was just not too far down the hall from where I worked. I didn't know her, but we knew that they were doing that planning, because every time something would change in the war planning, it was reflected in the Joint Chiefs of Staff, of course. And we knew there were changes because Kennedy was telling people to come home, and all of a sudden the word went out to build a force up. Something changed drastically. And the other side of it is, I have never been able to find out why, or to even find a rational idea in my own mind, why the Kennedy cabinet was on the way to Tokyo at the time he was killed. I don't know of any time when most of the cabinet for any president was going any further than across the river. You know, here they all were on an airplane on the way from Honolulu to Tokyo when they hear about the president being shot. That's quite unusual. Or even the little line in the Pentagon papers that says so much. Ambassador Lodge, who had come from Saigon to the meeting in Honolulu before a large staff, which is a customary thing, including these cabinet officers, then it said, on the 22nd of November, Ambassador Lodge flew to Washington to speak to the president. Didn't say which president, because by the time they wrote the Pentagon Papers, they knew President Kennedy had died. Why couldn't they find a little bit of space to put in President Johnson, because that's the day Kennedy died, or some? They go on for pages after that, never mention Kennedy's name, although it was the, I mean, why are people playing with the record like that? See, or why are they playing with the protection system in Dallas? And what's motivating the Strategic Air Command to do what it did? If people want to say that Castro or the Mafia or Khrushchev or anybody had the power to do that sort of thing, they're really not thinking clearly about what this assassination was. It was a major, controlled coup d'etat that was absolutely effective. Because if Oswald had any role at all, and he had been with the CIA, and I can tell you clearly that a Marine assigned to Atsugi was a selected CIA man, a Marine that can get out of his service and go to Russia and live for 18 months and then go back to the American embassy and say, I've decided not to leave the country, I'm going to go back to the States, and they give him his passport, and then the money to go back with his wife and child came from the State Department, they paid his way back. I mean, you know, what's going on? So there is so much of a fabric of this assassination, as you're pointing out, that really the hardest thing for me to see is why the Warren Commission had the temerity to even publish that document. I mean, the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court is putting his name to a document that I can't believe he didn't know was wrong, along with all the others. It's just unbelievable. Where did that pressure come from? How do you tell a Supreme Court justice what he's going to do? You can't do it by walking into the court with a staff of lawyers. He'll tell you what to do.
Well, my mother, who was in the Deputy Chief of Staff's Office for Personnel, was planning manpower analysis and national draft call figures 5 years in advance, and knew that there were plans to withdraw the troops from Vietnam. Mm-hmm. And I know that you were in meetings in that period, at mm-hmm. the end of the Kennedy administration, where those plans were being discussed, and that there were national security memoranda developed about it. There's quite a bit of controversy now in the press, and many claims that this is a sort of absurd motive that Stone has given, or a fanciful idea. And I wondered if you could speak to whether or not you feel, from your experience there and what evidence you had at the time, that in fact Kennedy would have pulled out of Vietnam entirely.
This has been one of the surprises of my work with the film. You see, I was familiar with this National Security Action Memorandum number 263, which was dated October 11th, 1963. The principal finding of that memorandum was that Kennedy was going to bring all U.S. personnel, didn't say military, didn't say CIA, didn't say State Department, all U.S. personnel out of Vietnam by the end of 55. The next day, the world around printed U.S. Stars and Stripes paper that's for the military. That was a headline, all Americans out by 65. You know, it was not a secret. It wasn't casual. It was a major importance. And yet, some of these writers who have attacked Stone for the veracity of his film ought to know better. It's a public document. But more than that, I have a government printing office book, and of course I have my own records too, because I was working on these papers, that was printed in 1991, current, and it shows clearly in the period from August to November 1963, that there were more than 50 meetings that were attended by Kennedy, Rusk, McNamara, and Maxwell Taylor. Sometimes Kennedy might not have been there, but then he'd be represented by either Bundy or somebody else like that. And my boss. My boss is referenced in every one of those meetings, General Krulak. And when General Krulak would come back from those meetings, the usual thing was to call to us, one or two or three of us there, here's what happened today, here's what we've got to do tomorrow, you research this, we'll put it together, and for tomorrow when you go back to meeting, we've had all this material for him. Now, we worked intensively on this program for that period, August until November. It was not a casual program. We had access, in my part, I had access to CIA. The other part of the staff had access to NSA. We had access to the money crowd. We would be up on Congress on Capitol Hill. It was a completely controlled effort by the president. He sat there running these committees. It was not some thing held like the Iran-Contra hearings by somebody brought in for the job. The president was running. So anybody that wants to say that the film overemphasizes the significance of that paper and Kennedy's intent thoroughly to get Americans out of Vietnam, it doesn't understand history. And he didn't say he was going to leave Vietnam high and dry. There's more to it. He said he was going to build Vietnamese forces. He was going to supply them with what they needed. He was going to pump money into Vietnam, but not American troops. And in 1963, for those who haven't looked at their history carefully, no American military people were operating in Vietnam under military commanders. They were all assigned to a structure that was under CIA operational control. Now, there's a big difference between American troops under CIA control or troops under their own commanders. They didn't have that situation, a real wartime situation, until the invasion in early 1965, after Johnson had completely turned Kennedy's plans around. So the importance of that document is enormous, but it wasn't the original one. It started back in 1961 in July with another document, number 55, that I won't go into, but historians should, because they can't understand how this other document came unless you know that for 2 years that planning was going on, and it would have continued on into after Kennedy's re-election into his second term. We'd have been out of Vietnam. There wouldn't have been a war in Vietnam.
That turnaround that Johnson presided over, I know, was at least at the planning stage by the Monday following the Kennedy assassination, when my mother was given figures by the Joint Chiefs to plan for a 10-year war and 57,000 dead.
Ahead of time.
Yes. You know, that was on November 25th, 1963, she was given those figures.
They were accurate, weren't they?
Yes.
The planning for how many?
10-year war and 57,000 dead, right on target.
We had, we lost 58,000 men.
Yes, 57.5 or 58.
It's amazing, see? And
so it wasn't, I think, just a reversal of policy. It was really a leap forward, a complete conceptual change, it seems to me, in the way the war would be carried out.
There was a document in draft form, written, strangely enough, on November 21st of 1963. And the draft form of the document that President Johnson signed on the 26th of November is called National Security Action Number 273. But the draft is interesting because there doesn't seem to be in the government documents any of the detail that we have on the 263. This just appeared by itself. They claim as a result of this Honolulu conference that was so strange. And yet, there's a major change in the philosophy of the Kennedy papers as it sort of swings over into the Johnson era. But that was written before Kennedy died. It was dated November 21st. It was just a draft, but it was dated November 21st. Mr. Bundy, who was in the White House at that time, sent that draft, and he may have been the originator of that draft, according to what we hear, to his brother, William Bundy, who was in the Defense Department with us, with the note on it that, I have worked on this, would you read it, see what you think about it, and show it to McNamara? Well, the interesting thing is, if you read Arthur Schlesinger or any of the others who were involved in this Honolulu conference, that McGeorge Bundy, the author of the draft, and Mr. McNamara came back from Honolulu on the same plane, flying practically all day, although Schlesinger says they left at night, but, you know, flying together for many, many hours on the plane. What was to stop Mr. Bundy from showing it to Mr. McNamara while they were flying? They were right there together. So there's enough there to present the feeling that somehow somebody knew things were going to change within the next couple of days. It's like Lodge's trip to talk with the president. Which president, see? Yeah. These are fascinating little details from the manpower viewpoint of your mother's work to these others, and none of them have been answered. None are adequately answered.
Do you have a sense, you mentioned Oswald and his defection to the Soviet Union and strange circumstances under which he would return. Do you have a sense from your work in support of the intelligence community how a patsy like this could be set up? Are there pools of such characters, doubles, cutouts? I mean, how is something like this done? Where are they chosen from? And to what extent do you think Oswald meets that pattern? Also, who do you think set Oswald up? In my work, the role of George de Morenshield, Ruth and Michael Payne, who are depicted as the Williams in Stone's movie, were central to moving Oswald in Dallas, who he knew, where he went, all the jobs that Oswald had seemed to have intelligence connections, and he seemed to be somebody that just was taking orders until he got to the position where he realized where the orders were leading him.
I have no difficulty in seeing Oswald through his brief career as a CIA man, from his Marine work to going to Russia, coming back to Dallas, where instead of meeting Marxist Russians, he met Demoranshild and these other throwback to the white Russians, you know, the anti-Marxist Rush Bull. And why did that community pick him up if he had proclaimed himself a Marxist? And then this unusual occurrence that he was just happened to have this job in the school depository building only 2 weeks before the president's car was set to go by. That's the typical leading role that you use an agent for. You move him into things so that when something is needed. Why did he work with a photography company that was doing highly classified army photography work? How did he get into those things if he wasn't right in the middle of intelligence work? I have no problem in, I mentioned Atsugi, no problem. He wouldn't have been at Atsugi if he wasn't in this kind of work. And then with the assassination, I would say that his role, he probably didn't know this, was to provide for the mechanics, two men or three men, the positioning they needed for the little structural work they do before they fire their guns, like maybe the week before. And then like the old pirate, after he's raided the ship, he goes and buries his gold on a desert island, and he has these people dig a big deep hole and throw the gold in there. What does he do first? He shoots them, drops them in with the gold, and then nobody tells where the gold is, see? So you have to get rid of Oswald, not because he was a killer of Kennedy. That wasn't what Ruby's job was, to keep his mouth quiet. That's a little fantasy, but how else could his role have come around to that? And it fits the pattern because the mechanics are not from this country, and they need somebody that can get them into the Daltex building, the depository building, up on a grassy knoll, or wherever they were. You know, they can't do that by themselves. They can't ask a policeman for the help. And that man is going to be removed. That's where the patsy comes in.
Were some of the people who carried on these earlier historical operations then in a position to run this operation at the ground level in Dallas? Who was in Dealey Plaza?
Yeah, you would never know, because the coding won't permit face-to-face. You'll remember in Oliver Stone's movie where he's using dramatic license, but you only see a man on the phone in profile, and he's answering a few questions, and he just simply says yes. Now, he would have received that call by code. It wouldn't have been John Judge calling Fletch Prouty, you know, and then he would know that he will receive orders, again coded, because he has to call somebody to have these people get down to Dallas. They're not in this country. Well, when you do that, I mean, there is no way you are ever going to run it backwards. And I don't care if they release all the files that have ever been buried, they aren't going to reveal that because it's gone. Nor will it ever reveal who made that first call to this contact man who knows the codes that can put everything else in motion, because that's all he's going to say is, you know, when I make those calls, I know three other people were called, and I don't think the people I called were the ones involved. My men were going to go to China and shoot somebody. See, it's like the old mafia system that they want me to shoot you, but we do it with four people, and you give four guns, but only three bullets. And of course, I had the blank, not the man beside me. I didn't shoot you. The other guys did. This is an old thing. King Henry II removed the cardinal, you know, back in the 12th century, and he never told anybody to do it. The knights did it because they knew King Henry would smile if the cardinal was gone. Nobody said shoot him.
You make a small reference, or at least Donald Sutherland, playing the character X, makes a reference to flying some of the Nazis out of Romania at the end of the war to help in the war against the communists. And you mentioned also during our interview meeting Wernher von Braun. As you know, von Braun came not only by himself, but with hundreds of aerospace and munitions and scientists from Project Paperclip. Also here in this country, many of the spies who worked early on for the CIA and the intelligence networks came from a network in Germany under Reinhard Gehlen, one of Hitler's top spies. I found in my work, and so did researcher Mae Brussel, who you knew, numerous Nazi connections to the John F. Kennedy assassination, including Walter Dornberger, a general who had been a mentor to von Braun and who actually thought up the idea of the space shuttle in Star Wars, was the employer for many years of Michael Payne, whose wife Ruth Payne housed Marina Oswald. Ruth Payne got Oswald the job at the book depository there at the corner in October. Mm-hmm. And in addition to that, de Morenshield had ties in his long family history to the Nazis. And even the person who wrote the Warren Commission report, Rudolf Augustus Winokur, came from the Army Historical Division, where he had worked since the 50s. He had been an official historian of the Reich for Adolf Hitler and was brought into this country. And the Army Historical Division was apparently the early drop point for the Galen Network. And I wondered if you had a sense in your work of the role that these Nazis played when they came in and how central they were to the Cold War history.
The reason I've alluded to the work of the OSS in Bucharest, in Romania, under Frank Wisner, one of their leading agents, is because that as the Soviet army was coming to the border of Romania, there was an interval of about 10 days where the Germans were fleeing and the Russians were coming in. A peace treaty was signed with Romania by the United States and the Great Britain. And in that little interlude, they rounded up 750 American POWs, mostly air crewmen, have been bombing the Ploesti airfields. And I received a call from General Giles in Cairo to set up about 35, 40 aircraft to go to a little remote field in Syria where a freight train would come by. And we went there early in the morning, and these 750 American POWs jumped off the train, came running toward our planes to be flown to Cairo, and intermingled with these men, we didn't know it, we started talking to some of them on the airplane, were Nazis who were being taken out of Romania and the Balkans by the OSS for pretty obvious reasons. They knew all the intelligence in the Balkans, they knew the intelligence in the Ukraine and other adjoining areas of Russia, and they wanted to preserve them. They didn't want the communists, you know, even though Russia was our ally, I mean, this was the beginning of the Cold War. I had been ordered to fly into Russia only about 2 weeks before this other flight, and I lived up in Russia for a little while, doing a certain mission up there, which was army mission. You know, we had no knowledge at the time we went up there to Syria to pick up the American prisoners that among this group of 750 Americans, some British, that they were going to be these Nazi intelligence specialists. Of course, they weren't identified to us, but we realized they weren't Americans. It's only later, when we talked to the general in Cairo, that we found out who they were. And they were a top professional Nazi team that knew all the agent networks in the southern part of the Soviet Union, southwestern part, and the Balkans. So from that point of view, they were invaluable. But this was an effort run against the Soviet Union, our ally, at that period. And I believe that probably this is the first step on record of a Cold War move of major importance. Now, you talked about General Galen. The agreements made with Galen were made actually before the war ended. He had made a deal with certain American intelligence people, General Seibert for one, that he would lay low, bury his files, and surrender as soon as possible, rather than draw attention to himself on the Nazi side. And Galen, of course, was Hitler's prime intelligence general, a terrific prisoner for us to gain. But the object of this was basic to setting up the Cold War material, you see, because Galen's intelligence information accounted for the rest of the western part of the Soviet Union and all of Eastern Europe. And the discussions with Galen were led by Alan Dulles, who was in Switzerland as the OSS senior officer in that area. And it's a very interesting thing because Alan Dulles and his brother John Foster Dulles were with this large law firm in New York, Sullivan Cromwell. Sullivan Cromwell had offices throughout Germany, all through the 30s. And the Dulles brothers were very close to the Tyson Steel Works and IG Farben Company. In fact, interestingly enough, the agency's headquarters in Germany after the war was in Frankfurt, Germany, in the IG Farben building. You know, it just happened that way. Well, the Dulles contacts that people thought would be OSS intelligence work were actually the people he knew anyway as a result of his legal work in Germany, while the Nazis were, while Hitler was running Germany. And if you'll recall the history, like many other American companies, even though World War II started, as far as England and France were concerned, and Holland and Belgium and all, and Poland had been attacked, American companies did not close their offices. Union Bank from New York didn't close its offices in Germany, nor did the Sullivan Cromwell, until Pearl Harbor. And then they more or less had to. But then, through intelligence, they retained contacts. And evidence of this is rather interesting. Before the Germans surrendered, the foreign minister was a man named Count Schwerin von Krosigk. And von Krosigk, who knew about some of this undercover contact and wanted to save his own neck, made a speech in Berlin that is reported in the London Times of May 3rd, 1945, before the German surrender. The subject of that speech was the Iron Curtain. And when Winston Churchill, who at that time was not in the government, he had been voted out the Potsdam Conference. I forget the dates, but you know. Anyway, Churchill read that in the Times. A little later, he wrote to Harry Truman. He had never met President Truman. And he started talking about how the communists were going to drop an iron curtain over Eastern Europe. He was using the same words and almost the same speech as the German foreign minister had. Now, the foreign minister's idea came from his OSS friends, and you see the Cold War began to roll. And by the time Churchill spoke in Missouri at Westminster College, everybody credited him with the invention of the Iron Curtain idea and the activities in Eastern Europe, because that fit the scenario of the developing Cold War. It wouldn't have gone over if he said, "Oh, I copied this from the Nazi general that gave, I mean, a foreign minister that gave the speech." You see how the interlinking.
Yes.
And Frank Wisner then became one of the leading men in CIA, in the early CIA, before the law created CIA. We had OPC. That was done to keep the records together during the interim between the end of OSS and the law making the CIA. Well, Wisner is the one who carried that through. So the linkage there, as you've just pointed out, was very important.
I assume that the same Galen network or the remnants of it still existed by 1963 and may have been part of what was threatened when Kennedy said in October that he would splinter the CIA into 1,000 pieces.
Galen, oddly, was brought to the United States by direction of Walter Beadle Smith, General Smith, who was Eisenhower's chief of staff. Smith became the ambassador to Russia immediately upon the end of the war, following Averell Harriman, who had been there all through the war. He flew Galen with all his files that he had buried to Washington, Andrews Field, and by special act of the U.S. Congress, General Galen of Nazi Germany was made an American general. He worked here for a while, was brought back to Germany in Frankfurt in the IG Farben building, and then from there, Adenauer, the new leader of Germany, of West Germany, moved him to Bonn, where he became the head of German intelligence, as he should have been, because it's a little awkward to have him be an American general. So he became the head of German intelligence for many, many years. All the time I was active, he was still there.
Mm-hmm. I understood from 45 to 48, about 300 of his spies came in to work with CIA, and others came from the Nazi Quisling governments, the Belarusian government, the White Russian government sent about 300 people here to the United States that worked in Radio for Europe and Radio America and Voice of America and these different things.
You mentioned Walter Dornberger.
Yes.
Dornberger was von Braun's boss at Peenemünde, one of the greatest rocket scientists that's ever lived. And when I was writing this book I referred to for the ROTC program, I went to Buffalo, where Dornberger had offices in the Bell Corporation, and I interviewed him at length on their rocket program, because we had nothing like it in the United States, and I had to go to the best source, so the Air Force told me to go see Dornberger. Well, the link between Nazi Peenemünde and their rockets And the Bell Corporation and the acquisition of Bell by the Textron Corporation and the gaining of the big helicopter contract for Vietnam, the Huey helicopters, and then into some of the lore of the Dallas era, which you've mentioned, in the Payne family and people like that. It's just too linked to be casual, see? And I know from the talks I had over a few days with Walter Dornberger that he was well aware of the fact. In fact, he told me that he was trying to help Bell get ahead with jet engines. That was new in those days. And he did. Bell had a fine jet airplane for a while. But they moved quickly in helicopters where there was a big opening. And it was because of Dornberger's experience and his relationship with von Braun and the people who had brought him out of Germany. Yeah. And later we had a more or less formal program within the structure that I was working in called Deep Water Flights. We flew thousands of Germans from CIA's air base in Wiesbaden to Andrews Field in the United States. There's a book out called Blowback that tells the story, but thousands of them. Many were technical experts, and we needed the technical experts and so on. But this is what tended to heat up the Cold War so fast.
I always thought it was significant that both Alan Dulles, who you mentioned in terms of the plans for the secret surrender of Galen after the war, and the High Commissioner of Germany, the Allied High Commissioner after the war, John J. McCloy, mm-hmm. who worked with Sullivan and Cromwell and was a Rockefeller banker for many years, sat on the Warren Commission. McCloy was responsible for pardoning many of the key Nazis at the time of the Nuremberg trials. Another key figure in this scenario, I think, is Leon Jaworski, who worked for the Army at the Nuremberg trials, I believe undermined the prosecution of the Nazis at those trials, came back, left there and worked for International Red Cross Rescue Division, which provided the Glossenspiel, the phony IDs for some of the Ratline Nazis, the movement of Nazis out of Germany under false ID or to hide them in the DP camps. And he later worked for a CIA conduit fund, the J.M. Anderson Fund in Dallas, and then suddenly shows up as the official liaison between the Dallas police and the Warren Commission investigation. And later on, of course, is the most trusted man in America when he handles the cover-up of both the Watergate and Koreagate interests.
Well, in the Dallas area, ostensibly, I believe, to provide counsel to Oswald, who didn't live more than 48 hours. Interesting linkages.
When you were at this level, I mean, I'm sure you got a sense of how things are done. You mentioned earlier that some disgruntled oil men or angry Cubans or mafia enemies of Kennedy could not have pulled off the job at the level it was done, nor have covered it up. To move beyond that level, could the Joint Chiefs of Staff or the Defense Intelligence Agency or the CIA or a renegade element in those groups have pulled off the job and covered it up, or does it go beyond that?
The answer, of course, is not simple, but it's tucked away in facts that we all can think about. The Central Intelligence Agency is called an agency on purpose. Law makes it that, which means then it works for somebody. See, an agency doesn't work for itself. The Defense Department works for itself, but the agency works for others. The Defense Intelligence Agency, the National Security Agency, they used to all be under the office I worked in under General Erskine for the Secretary of Defense called the Office of Special Operations. We provided the linkage to CIA and to NSA. DIA didn't exist, but General Erskine is the creator of DIA. He wrote the thing. So you notice the A in the agency there means that higher authority can use the agency. And at that point, you learn pretty quick that higher authority doesn't necessarily wear a uniform or the pinstripe of State Department. It's higher. I remember during the war hearing that a close friend of Winston Churchill, Lord Denning, who some would like the Chief Justice here, would talk about Churchill he knew Denning very well, in his just conversational talk, using the term high cabal. And he would turn to friends and say, you know, if Churchill is talking about a high cabal, what's up above there, see? But we live with that. We know that. And you've mentioned different companies that have been in journalism, like Sullivan Cromwell, and the links between IG Farben and General Electric had. But if you study those structures, the Brown and Harriman interests, they existed in Germany all through this period and only reluctantly closed down at the Pearl Harbor time, but the linkages remained. As soon as the war ended, they were right back in there again, you see. These are important to try to understand this because, in my point of view, the Kennedy family was oriented more to the European power structure than they were to Asia. And I think that had a lot to do with why Kennedy didn't want to get involved in Vietnam. He'd much rather see our money and our forces and our interests back in Asia, where his friends and his father's business friends, who were among the group in Brown and Harriman and so on, that's where they worked.
I thought it was interesting that some of the founders of Brown and Harriman, as well, Averell Harriman and some of the key bankers that were linked to the Deutsche Bank and the money in Germany in those years were Skull and Bones graduates in Yale in, I believe it's 1909, along with Prescott Bush, George Bush's father. And he seems to have had financial and other ties with them going way back.
Prescott Bush was running the Combine. In fact, I think for a while he ran Union Bank, which was part of that. And of course, it all goes back, in one respect, to the enormous wealth derived from the oil industry. And to understand that, you begin to see some of these other horizons, and we may want to talk about that one of these days, because if there is this much being done at the high cabal level, you have to believe that it is being done because of enormous amounts of money. And just for one little clue, lifting the corner of the tarpaulin here a bit, between 1973 and 1980, when we had the energy crisis and we're waiting at gas stations with our cars to buy a little bit of gas at an exorbitant price, the same oil sources in the Middle East, five countries, that received $15 billion for their oil in 1973 received $300 billion for roughly the same quantity of oil in 1980. So it's so profitable. I mean, how can you think there isn't an interest in the oil business and their bankers and their lawyers and the collateral firms like the automobile industry and the aviation industry that run with it?
Well, I think it's only here in America where the press and the pundits and the historians even seem to buy into the idea of coincidence theory, that nothing links to anything else, whereas in Europe the immediate question in a political assassination is qui bono, or who benefits. Mm-hmm. And what are those benefits besides the profit? It would seem to me that the motivating forces behind conspiracies on this level are not only the profit, but it's and its perpetuity, but control of resources around the world, like oil, and other types of political control.
And unfortunately, it leads into another area that is too much overlooked, is the disregard for the peoples of many of these other areas. Because in a search for oil, sometimes the people that are already there get in the way. And so you begin to accept Malthusianism that, well, it wouldn't hurt to wipe the people out. They're not going to have enough food anyway. And Darwin said the fittest are going to survive, but not the unfit. So if there's a little genocide, 2,000 or 3,000 Iraqis die because of Desert Storm, don't worry about it because they're going to die anyway. Malthus proved it. Darwin convinced us that the better people will... You know, that's behind a lot of this, not just capitalism, communism, and so on. And yet, under the ground in Arabia, in Iraq, is one of the biggest oil reserves known in the whole world. So we're protecting interests in Iraq. The Iraqis don't own those companies.
How do you think, from this point, the case in the John F. Kennedy assassination could best be solved? I know that getting the records loose is one of the goals that we've been working on recently, but those records are not going to tell us the whole story. They're little snapshots. It's worth looking at them. We get a little bigger piece of the picture. But ultimately, what should we research if we're going to do that? What's the next step?
Because this hurdle has been established that so many records are out of reach, we've got to erase that. It would surprise me if it's much more than a decoy deal. But there's material in there, and experts know how to read these records and get more out of them than the congressman did. Because if the congressman got the answers out, you can be sure they would have rushed to the papers. But they hid the records because probably they were worthless. But anyway, we should get them because they must be removed. But the next thing is, and this is what's going to, I was talking to Oliver Stone about this last night. The people are going to see his movie and they're getting interested. So they're getting interested in freeing these records from this control that there's 75 years. But the next step is, if they're freed, and if the Warren Commission report is just demolished, and we know that Oswald was nothing but a patsy and so on, the American public is going to sit back and they're going to say, all right, now why was Kennedy killed? What really is behind this? These records don't prove it. The Warren Commission didn't, you know, there was something more. And can you imagine what that's going to be? That's the explosion that's around the corner. This film is only starting it. But when the records come free, we'll study them. And there may be a lot more in there than most people think. The congressman must not have thought so, but I want him to bring the military records out with the CIA and FBI and other files. I think ONI, the Navy, will have records that they didn't even see up there. Once that's done, at least we know what the platform is. But that next step is going to be big, because who can give the authority to act upon what's in the records? I would say only Congress, as a almost by unanimous vote, and the president, you know, or one of the other trying to outgun the other one. And right now, I don't see Congress able to unite behind it. And if they aren't able to unite behind it, I think Mr. Bush or any other president will sort of ignore the problem, because every president since Kennedy has been killed says the Warren Commission suffices as far as he's concerned. He's perfectly happy with the lone gunman up there on a sixth floor. Give or take Lyndon Johnson's recanting of that a few months before he died, when he said, I believe in a conspiracy, Oswald didn't do it alone, and we operate Murder Incorporated. We murder perpetually. Now, I think that winds up the story at that point.
We know that many of the witnesses, Penn Jones, the researcher suggests maybe as many as 175, have died strangely or in violent circumstances. We know that much of the evidence has been destroyed or altered since the time of the Kennedy assassination. And we know that the phony autopsy that was done at Bethesda was an illegal autopsy under Texas law, and that the body should have never been removed. One researcher in a recent meeting in Dallas, where I was on the case, suggested walking into the courthouse there in Dallas and convening a grand jury and beginning a full trial investigation in Dallas with the evidence that's left, the witnesses that haven't come forward, and putting it back on route. Do you think that there's a possibility at that level of opening it up as a trial or an investigation?
John, you don't have to research that. The law of the United States is that every murder must be tried in the state where it occurred. The state of Texas owes us a trial. You can have a trial against John Doe. So you're right. The means are there, and it has to be done according to law. And there's nothing to stop the state of Texas from doing that, except Lyndon Johnson told them, don't do it, see? But that's a fabricated thing, too, see? That's the story, up to here anyway.